This is VOA News via remote. Women, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas-led Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip held on Saturday as Egyptian mediators pressed on with talks with the two sides on securing longer-term calm. Officials are saying the ceasefire began before dawn on Friday, and Palestinians and Israelis are now assessing the damage from 11 days of hostilities in which Israel pounded Gaza with airstrikes and militants fired barrages of rockets at Israel. Taiwan reported another rise in domestic COVID-19 cases on Saturday, but the health minister said the trend remains stable with new infections concentrated in the northern part of the island in and around Taipei. After months of keeping the pandemic under control, Taiwan is dealing with a surge in domestic infections. Myanmar's junta leader Min Aung Hlaing said deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi was healthy at home and would appear in court in a few days in his first interview since overthrowing her in a February 1st coup. The coup has plunged the Southeast Asian country into chaos, and one of several ethnic armed groups opposed to the ruling junta advanced to attack a military post in a northwestern jade mining town on Saturday, the local media is reporting. China will uphold the leadership of the Communist Party in Tibet to further its economic development and guide Tibetan society in accordance to socialism, the region's top official said Saturday. Chinese troops entered Tibet in 1950, and a year later, the Chinese government formally gained control over the region and its devoutly Buddhist Tibetans. The Dalai Lama fled Tibet in 1959 following a failed uprising against Chinese rule. This is VOA News. The Philippines and China held friendly and candid talks on the South China Sea, the Philippines Foreign Ministry said Saturday, days after the minister ordered Chinese vessels out of the disputed waterway in an expletive-laced tweet. The presence of hundreds of Chinese vessels inside the Philippines' 200-mile exclusive economic zone has been the latest source of tensions between the two countries in the South China Sea, through which $3 trillion worth of goods pass each year. China's Mars rover drove from its landing platform and began exploring the surface on Saturday, state-run Xinhua News Agency says, making the country only the second nation to land and operate a rover on the Red Planet. Amnesty International has named one of Cuba's leading dissidents a prisoner of conscience, saying state security appeared to have him under supervision and incommunicado at the hospital where authorities admitted him nearly 3 weeks ago. Artist Luis Manuel Otero Alcantara had been staging a hunger and thirst strike for 7 days at his home in Old Havana to protest what he called state harassment when health officials transferred him to the hospital on May 2nd. Forensic workers unearthed the remains of multiple victims from a grisly crime scene in El Salvador, digging up more bodies on Friday from a pit at the home of an ex-police officer suspected of murdering and burying potentially dozens of women. Authorities confirmed 8 bodies have so far been removed from under the house of former officer Hugo Ernesto Osorio, a convicted rapist who prosecutors have formally charged with the killing of 2 women and 2 men earlier this month. Lebanon's Prime Minister-designate Saeed al-Hariri said Saturday he will not form a cabinet that simply caters to the current president's wishes. He said, quote, "I will only form the kind of government needed to stop collapse and prevent the big crash that is threatening the Lebanese." Hariri told this to a parliament session on Saturday. And Hungary's Roma community has been largely left out of the country's aggressive COVID-19 immunization rollout and has been forced to fend for itself. That's what leaders of the poverty-stricken minority are saying today. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman reporting for VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga.
At this point, I'm quite happy that he's dead, and I pray he's dead for real. And that alone will probably reduce the insecurity we have in Nigeria, because their leader is dead.
Nigeria's military investigates reports that Boko Haram leader Abubakar Sekau has died after blowing himself up to avoid capture by a rival terrorist group.
Direct incorporates the reported COVID deaths, as well as those COVID deaths that were missed because people died without testing. And what I mean by indirect, these are the deaths that can be attributed to the difficult conditions that many people in the world are living under because of the pandemic.
The World Health Organization releases its annual statistics report on world health with estimates of the global deaths from the COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Nigeria's military says it's investigating reports that Boko Haram leader Abubakar Sekau has died after blowing himself up to avoid capture by a rival terrorist group. Despite past reports claiming Sekau's death, which proved to be false, many Nigerians are celebrating in hopes that they may finally be rid of the militant Islamist. Timothy Abiezu reports from Abuja.
The latest report on Abubakar Sekau's death this week may be the most widely believed claim about the death of the Boko Haram sect leader in the last 5 years. Sekau reportedly detonated a bird-strapped explosive Wednesday evening after he and his men were overpowered and surrounded by rival group Islamic State of West Africa Province, ISWAP, during a fierce gun battle in his Sambisa Forest hideout. While the Nigerian military has said it is investigating the claim, many citizens like Abuja resident Kelvin Godwin are rejoicing.
At this point, I'm quite happy that he's dead, and I pray he's dead for real. And that alone will probably reduce the insecurity we have in Nigeria, because their leader is dead.
Some security experts are in doubt. Ebenezer Oyetakin says it is too early to celebrate.
Everyone, including the Nigerian military, have all the reasons in this world to be skeptic about whether he had been captured or he had committed suicide, as some claimed. He seems to be not only a cat with 9 lives. I think the lives is more than 18 or so, because in the past, both military, joint military, and all of that have claimed he was killed.
The Nigerian government has battled a militant Islamist insurgency started by the Sekau-led Boko Haram since 2009. In April 2014, the group rose to global notoriety after the audacious kidnapping of 276 schoolgirls from a government secondary school in the town of Chibok. But 2 years later, some of Sekau's fighters defected, pledging their allegiance to the Islamic State militant group and created the ISWAP. A power struggle between the two groups has simmered ever since. Oyetakin says if Sekau's death is verified, rivalry among militants could be an opportunity for Nigerian military to intensify its offensive against the insurgents.
I only hope that the regional security forces, namely Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin Republic, should come together strongly and leverage upon these weaknesses that is ongoing, because they are still fighting themselves. The Sekau people are still fighting back in the resistance, and the other people are in pursuit.
Experts also say Sekau's death could also allow a more tactical terrorist force with foreign affiliations to flourish in Nigeria. Attacks from the Boko Haram and ISWAP factions are responsible for killing more than 30,000 in Nigeria and displacing millions of people from their homes. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The World Health Organization is releasing its annual statistics report on world health. The report estimates the global deaths from the COVID-19 pandemic is at least 3 million. However, it believes the true figures are at least 2 to 3 times higher. Leisure Slein reports from Geneva.
As of December 31st, 2020, 3.4 million COVID-related deaths have been officially reported to the World Health Organization. But based on excess deaths since the pandemic began, WHO officials believe the official figure represents a significant undercount and that the true number is at least 2 to 3 times higher. WHO data analyst William Samburi says the organization is working with other UN agencies to quantify both the direct and indirect impacts of COVID-19.
Direct incorporates the reported COVID deaths, as well as those COVID deaths that were missed because people died without testing. And what I mean by indirect, these are the deaths that can be attributed to the difficult conditions that many people in the world are living under because of the pandemic. These conditions have made patients avoid healthcare, which has increased deaths and other causes.
Samburi says the pandemic has taken a severe socioeconomic toll, resulting in increases in diseases like depression. He says treating COVID emergency patients has taken priority over those suffering from other diseases. The report finds the pandemic has disrupted health services for many life-threatening diseases and poses major threats to health and well-being beyond the dangers of COVID-19 itself. WHO Assistant Director General in the Division of Data and Analytics, Samira Asma, says prior to COVID-19, life expectancy was going up.
We made great strides in global life expectancy, which was increasing with gains in healthy life expectancy as well. Yet the pandemic has had a deleterious impact on these gains, and we are learning from several countries already that life expectancy has declined by 2 to 3 years.
The statistics report says global life expectancy at birth increased from 66.8 years in 2000 to 73.3 years in 2019, with healthy life expectancy up from 58.3 to 63.67 years prior to the pandemic. Greatest gains were made in low-income countries. It notes global tobacco use is down by 33% since 2000, but adult obesity is rising, affecting 1/4 of populations in wealthy countries. It says non-communicable diseases account for 7 of 10 causes of global deaths. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Campaigners say that 8 executives and investors in companies making coronavirus vaccines have become billionaires in the last year thanks to the patents on their inoculations, and are calling for the pharmaceutical firms to share their technology so that global production of vaccines can be quickly increased as infections continue to surge in many poorer nations. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Coronavirus vaccines have transformed the fight against COVID-19, but they have also transformed the personal finances of several individuals involved in their development, according to the People's Vaccine Alliance, a group of non-profits campaigning for equitable global access to vaccines, which includes the charity Oxfam. Max Lawson is Oxfam's head of inequality.
The pharmaceutical corporations behind some of the most famous COVID-19 vaccines, like the company Pfizer, for instance, or Moderna, they're making huge profits from the monopoly they have on these vaccines. And as a result, their investors and their CEOs are becoming billionaires for the first time ever.
They include the chief executive officers of US pharmaceutical firm Moderna and the German firm BioNTech, according to analysis by the People's Vaccine Alliance. The alliance claims seven other executives or investors involved with Moderna and the Chinese firm CanSino Biologics have also become billionaires.
These COVID-19 vaccines were funded by public money, by taxpayers like you and I. So these are not the property of these companies, and they should not be used to deliver these enormous profits.
The patents on the vaccines mean the pharmaceutical firms can dictate the price and distribution of the drugs, says Lawson.
Because of these monopolies, we're ending up with an artificial scarcity, and it's quite enough space for these companies to make a decent return, not obscene profits, not creating billionaires, but also at the same time share their technology, share their intellectual property, and allow every competent vaccine manufacturer on earth to be producing the vaccines we need.
In a statement, BioNTech said that it had already increased its production capacity up to 3 billion doses in 2021. The firm added that patents are not the limiting factor to produce the vaccine, which is, in its words, a complex process developed over more than a decade. Moderna did not respond to requests for comment by the time of publication. Poorer countries are facing a dramatic shortfall in the supply of vaccines. The United States this month declared its support for a move to suspend patents on coronavirus vaccines, first suggested by India and South Africa. The issue topped the agenda at a global health summit held by the G20 group of industrialized nations in Rome Friday. In a joint declaration, the G20 called for voluntary licensing and technology transfers, but stopped short of supporting a suspension of vaccine patents. The European Union pledged to give 100 million vaccine doses to poorer nations this year and build vaccine production hubs in Africa. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Spain, one of the early epicenters of the COVID pandemic, has been rushing to get its population vaccinated. 33% now have received at least a first dose. However, aid agencies and advocates estimate many of the country's 1 million undocumented migrants are not getting vaccinated because of fear. Jonathan Speer narrates this report from Alfonso Berto in Barcelona.
Spain is among the few European nations whose national vaccination program aims to reach everyone in its territory, including immigrants whose status is classified as irregular.
Spain and Holland are the only countries that explicitly mention irregular migrants in their national vaccination strategies.
On paper, it looks good, but migrant advocates question whether Spain can implement that strategy. As in the US and some other countries, Spain's rollout is not managed centrally. Each region implements its own policy, and enforcement of the general directives from Madrid can vary. So inequalities in the regions can occur, say some analysts, depending on whether local leaders see outreach to migrant populations as a priority.
Mediation and cultural translation are tools that could enable access by these immigrant groups.
Spanish-speaking immigrants from Latin America have an easier time answering questions and accessing vaccines. But for those who do not speak Spanish, access is more complicated. A big problem is immigration status, as in the case of Guinean Musa Sow, who has applied for asylum in Spain.
Asilo, pero ellos...
They sent me away saying, denied, denied. But now I'm here waiting to see what day I'm going to have papers. If you do not have papers, you cannot do anything.
Like many young African migrants here, Sao knows that he needs to learn how to speak Spanish well. But before that happens, he wants a shot.
Yes, I want to get vaccinated because of this disease. One must get immunized in order not to catch the coronavirus.
Pero hay mucha gente no quiere vacunar, pero hay mucha gente que quiere vacunar.
Many of those undocumented say they don't want to register to be vaccinated because they fear being deported.
Hay algunos que no se registran porque tienen miedo.
Yes, I want to get vaccinated because of this disease. One must get immunized in order not to catch the coronavirus.
Ilegales, yo creo que la obligación de las administraciones públicas es localizarlos y ofrecerles la vacunación.
The Spanish government has made the Johnson & Johnson vaccine available to groups of non-regularized immigrants without a fixed address. This will make it easier to vaccinate more of the undocumented, since it is a single dose. For Alfonso Beato in Barcelona.
This week, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta presided over the official opening of the country's second port after Mombasa in the northern city of Lamu. The Chinese-built $3 billion port will serve Ethiopia, South Sudan, and other landlocked nations and compete for transshipments with ports in Djibouti and South Africa. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Speaking at the opening of the Lamu port, President Uhuru Kenyatta said it will be the gateway to the region.
So this indeed is a momentous feat, and it marks an important milestone towards the realization of our key objective of Vision 2030 to transform regional economies through increased trade, integration, and interconnectivity. As a critical pillar of the Lamu Port, South Sudan, Ethiopia Transport Corridor, this port will connect South Sudan, Ethiopia and Kenya.
Kenya's Vision 2030 plan aims to transform the country into an industrial and middle-income economy. Construction of the Lamu Port began in 2016. Since then, Kenya has been trying to woo its neighbours to use the port. In return, they will pay less for the goods that pass through. Kenyatta says the project is part of his country's effort to change the lives of its people.
A new chapter unfolds today in the development and transformation of Lamu, a chapter now that joins the transformation that is taking place in every part of our country.
Kenya already has a major port in Mombasa in the south of the country. Critics of the Chinese-built Lamu port say it may be of less economic value. Gerishoni Kiara is an international economic affairs lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says Lamu port's strategic location will help Kenya secure more revenue.
The Lamu port will help Kenya to have an advantage in lower costs of transportation. It's a short distance to especially southern Sudan and the parts of Ethiopia. So Kenya will access a greater market now for those. It will be able to get revenue from cargo in transit coming through the port to other countries.
Most businesses in Ethiopia, the second populous nation in Africa, use the Djibouti port. Kenya wants businesses in southern Ethiopia to use the Lamu port. Ikiara says the political volatility in Ethiopia and South Sudan may lead to less use of the new facility.
The insecurity now, instability in the area, fighting in Ethiopia, there are warring parties within Sudan, southern Sudan. So there are political, economic, infrastructural problems, and sometimes a bit of quarrels between the countries, so that they are not necessarily working on the same level at the same rate.
Kenya expects to complete the construction of the port in October and plans to invite leaders from neighbouring states to show them its potential and negotiate deal for their respective countries. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And fans, reporters, as well as players across East Africa are applauding the inaugural Basketball Africa League tournament in Kigali, Rwanda. They say the competition will go a long way to inspire and attract millions of young Africans. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji tells us more from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Basketball fan Albert Ahabwe says he's literally glued on his TV set so as not to miss a game since Basketball Africa League, or BAL, kicked off at the magnificent Kigali Arena in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, on Sunday.
What has impressed me is the resourcefulness, the facilities, the general feel of the tournament. It speaks of a professional, high-level organization. Some of the things are a proper NBA touch. The things that they put in the players' rooms, the equipment, the practice courts, the everything, the general logistics of the whole thing are not something Africa is used to.
Rwandan reporter Gakuba Felix Abdujabal, common known as Romario, agrees.
The level of the competition is really very high and very impressive. So I can say that we are actually enjoying the tournament itself because we've seen very good talented players, very young talented players, particularly in the Rwandan team, Patriot, which is representing the country. We have seen a lot of very good players that really have a potential. And more importantly, I can say that the bar will be very important for East Africa in particular and Africa in general, as it has really exposed a lot of talents that people really didn't know.
The competition was to have begun last year, but was put off in March 2020 because of the coronavirus pandemic. 12 teams across Africa are participating at the inaugural tournament, including host Patriots, who opened the tournament by beating Nigeria's River Hoppers 83-60, the excitement of local fans. Dini Karemela is a sports analyst in Rwanda.
I'm impressed by three things, basically. Number one, it is the ability for these people to pull off this tournament. And by doing that, they are showing the country's determination to change livelihoods and encourage partnerships that will, you know, grow Rwanda's economy sustainably over the foreseeable future. So for the country, that is a very big win. And number two, we've seen social media go crazy. And Rwanda, yes, Rwanda is out there. It is Visit Rwanda everywhere. But also it is an opportunity for us to export Rwanda's promising talents to professional leagues across the world.
Lizzie Akumu, who was recently summoned for the Kenya national basketball team, says he's learning a lot from the tournament.
The teams at BAL are top teams from different African countries, and this will help especially players to be appreciated and learn great deals, or rather opportunities, both in Africa and outside Africa. There is healthy competition from the teams, and like I said, BAL is a big platform, and just like every other competition, players are bringing out super competitive talents in them. And personally, watching BAL motivates a lot. Seeing players pushing themselves, making things work strategically to the last whistle is exciting, and I get to learn a lot too as a player.
Ugandan team captain Jimmy Enabu says to now be every basketball player's dream to feature at BAL.
This is where we want to play. So every year you compete in your local league and hope to emerge as a champion because you know that there is something higher. So looking at the BAL, this is very motivational for me, motivational for my teammates, because you always feel like there is always a level higher than the one that you're playing that you can push yourself to compete at.
Tanzania sports analyst Nasir Nchimbi also says he's greatly impressed by the BAL tournament and believes it came at the right time to excite fans after many days of horrifying COVID-19 pandemic.
For most Africans, it has been like a surprise. But for those who have been the major part of the process, are not surprised with the process, because the president of African Basket Association has been working hard to bring this game here into Africa. Kudos to the president of African Basket Association, Mr. Amadou Fall, together with the NBA commissioner, Mr. Adam Silver, for bringing the game here in Africa, because a lot of Africans have been dreaming of the game. How do they dream? By going abroad so that they can fulfill their dream. But right now, they
Now, VOA Africa's special coverage of the historical NBA Basketball African League Championship games in Rwanda. Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is Prince Nesta broadcasting from Washington. Welcome to VOA Africa's special coverage of the Basketball African League taking place in Rwanda. The home team Patriots of Rwanda and the Tunisian club US Monastir, considered one of the title favorites, are set to square it off in their final group game today at the Kigali Arena. Both sides are through to the quarterfinals after posting wins in their first two games. At stake is not only bragging rights, but also Group A's top spot. US Monastir have never won a continental competition and will be counting on power forward Radwan Slimani, while Arakji and former Sudanese refugee Ater Majok. The Patriots, on the other hand, will be banking on their 26-year-old 6'10" power center, London-based Rwanda international Prince Ibe, and former NBA G League player Brandon Costner. US multi-platinum rap artist Jermaine Cole, also known as J. Cole, is also expected to feature in the game.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Prince Nesta, and you're listening to special VOA Africa coverage of the Basketball African League in Rwanda. Our VOA listeners have heard analysis and commentary this week from Cheick Thiaro, a former professional basketball player from Mali. Cheick works in the VOA's French to Africa service, and he contacted African League President Amadou Gallo Fall for his thoughts on the inaugural competition.
Is it what do you expect from NBA to organize a historical moment in Africa right now, which is taking place in Kigali?
So Cheick, first of all, thank you, but also I want to congratulate you because we're proud of what you're doing. And as we talk about the Basketball Africa League, we want to build a basketball industry. We can see this league becoming, a place where not only the players playing on the court and the coaches can become professional, but also someone like you went to Basketball Without Borders, now working in broadcasting. We need broadcasters to, tell the story, around the world. And we are, in terms of coming back to our thoughts around this first week of games, first of all, really the footprint in terms of these games being distributed in 215 countries and 15 languages all across Africa and around the world is a big first step, So it's about really creating a compelling product on the court, and very, impressed with a lot of these teams, that coming out of the gate. The talent they have in their teams, and also the discipline and the level of expertise that I see from the sidelines, from different coaches, from different backgrounds. So I think it's a good step. It's been a good few days of games, and I can only see this getting better and more difficult as we move to the playoffs next week. So it's been a long time coming as we. That we were set to start in March 2020, and now have to wait all this time. But we used that time to really stay engaged and connected with our teams. We did a lot of work in terms of referee training and building capacity with our teams through some leadership series where we had some of the best basketball minds in the NBA come and exchange with our BAL team, from Coach Popovich to Glenn Casey, Steve Kerr, and other general managers in the league who came and just share their experience, talk about how they build cultures in the organization, the winning organization that they lead today. And we have very ambitious goals with our league. So this is why, for me, this has been a great start. But we're going to continue to work and to put forth the effort to make sure that this league in a few years is going to be one of the absolute best professional basketball league in the world.
Oh, we saw that a lot of Africans have been very shining in NBA. We see a good significant numbers of African players in NBA, and the list going on. I'm pretty sure you are aware of a lot of them, most of them pretty much. And we have so seen that one of the best player, African players right now, did basketball without a border with you, Joel Embiid, which is one of the top center in the United States, a good friend of mine. And also seen that a lot of players in college and high school level that have been inspired by your passion toward this game. We saw the Nigerian teams really have one of the only players in the league, Africa Basketball League, this year to experience playing against teams in the NBA. Do we expect to see on the recruiting side better recruitment for Nigerian team? Because we saw the NBA draft 2020 to top Africans to make it to NBA first round. And the first time in history, six of them was from Nigeria originally. And do you expect to see any change from this team so far from the tournament? Because it's the first time teams trying to figure it out how to come up with a better. Do you think we're going to see any change in the future from teams that have done tremendous good and teams that have done poorly?
Yeah, look, I think it's a start. So obviously, even all of us as a league, we're going to, have a lot of learning, because there will be so many firsts, in this inaugural season. So, it's going to be, a learning experience on a lot of level. But as far as just the talent, I think the talent can only improve. I mean, I'm, again, largely satisfied from most of what I've seen. Obviously, there's room for improvement always. As far as Nigeria, I'm not worried, because, even outside of those players you talk about that are in the U.S., really flying the flag, the Nigerian flag and the African flag very high, in Nigeria alone, there is enough talent to really, see an incredible local competition. Mm-hmm. They have to get the local championships going. And I think this team, as you see, that they are, they're just lacking in competition, because I understand that there hasn't been a formal local league in a couple of years for different reasons. But I'm pretty sure they will overcome that and for next season come back with a representative that is going to be among the best, because Nigeria is ranked in terms of international competition from a national team perspective number one both in men and women. So that needs to translate when it comes to club level. You see Tunisia, and Angola, when you look at US Monastir, you look at Petro, you look at SAP, even IS Duan, IS Talib, most of those players play in the domestic league, and they recruited, a few players who are either from the US or other parts. I know that Monastir has a player from Lebanon who is probably the best one guy in Asia, that they were able to attract. So the opportunity here is for the league to retain elite talent from the continent, develop elite talent from the continent, but attract also elite talent from all around the world. So this is why we are excited about the opportunity here to build one of the best professional basketball leagues in the world in years to come.
Well, you mentioned the local, and this is going to give the local players a lot of chance to also prove their talent to the world, because the world will see Africa talent through this BAL tournament. Do we expect to see any surprising recruitment from the NBA toward this league in Africa?
Ultimately, we are looking to grow a basketball industry right here on the continent. We always know that there is tremendous talent here, and the talent has always been exported, and now we want to make sure that that talent also gets to be showcased on the continent. What was lacking is a platform, and like the Basketball Africa League, now that it is here, I think the trickle-down effect is going to be the much improved local leagues, because you have to win your national league to qualify for the Basketball Africa League. So I already start seeing that in many countries where clubs are recruiting talent, are getting some locals who are playing in other leagues around the world, who just finished university in the U.S., going back home to play in their local league, because for the chance to qualify for the Basketball Africa League, which is a Champions League model. So, I could see improved quality in terms of the local leagues, and this is how you're going to grow the entire ecosystem, because we will run our season, let's say, around 3 months, but then the rest of the time, you want these local leagues to prosper. You want more talent from Africa to have opportunity to monetize their talent right here in Africa. And that's how you're going to build an industry. And it's only going to add to really also the strength of basketball around the world as the number two sport.
Dance Basketball African League President Amadou Galofon sharing his thoughts on the inaugural BAL competition in Rwanda. And he was talking with VOS French to Africa Service producer and former Malian professional basketball player Sheikh Thiero from Kigali, Rwanda. I'm Prince Nessa, and you're listening to special VOA Africa coverage of the Basketball African League in Rwanda. A top Kenyan coach says she thinks the Tunisian club US Monastir will win the inaugural Basketball African League Championship in Rwanda. Joining us now with more details is VOA Sunny Young. Sporty greetings, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Prince. Liz Mills, the female head coach of Kenya's national men's basketball team, is picking the Tunisian side, Monastir, to lift the trophy in Kigali on May 30th.
The favorites to win this, and if they don't make the finals, I would be shocked. This will be USM from Tunisia. This is basically the Tunisian national team with some imports. And we all are very aware of how strong their national team is. They're led by who I think is the best point guard in Africa, Omar Abada, and he's surrounded by elite veterans in Makram Ben Romdan and Murad El Mabrouk. So they all start from the Tunisian national team, three starters in your team plus imports. This team is really well coached. They've got a young coach. He's 35. They recently won the Tunisian title again, and they've got great depth. So I would be, they're a team worth keeping an eye on. They've got some great players. And then it's in terms of who they would play in the final, for me, it's either going to be Petro de Luanda from Angola or Zamalek from Egypt.
The Australian coach, Liz Mills, says she's proud to be the first woman to lead a men's national basketball team to a major continental tournament. Mills guided the Kenyan men's team to its first qualification for the AfroBasket Championship Tournament in 28 years.
Have Kenya got anything left in the tank? They played so well. It's been an incredible performance. A long two is good! Unreal! Extraordinary play! Extraordinary moment! Kenya have beaten Angola at the buzzer!
Reflecting on that extraordinary moment, Liz Mills looks back on her coaching career.
I started coaching basketball at 16 and then decided to take it pretty seriously by studying sports science and sports management at university. And then I did my master's in coaching in 2013.
With her master's in coaching, Liz Mills says she's also brought some new strategies and tactics to Kenyan men's basketball.
Me coming in allowed this team to elevate its game in terms of playing a more international style of basketball that is continental, that we see at FIBA events. So more structure on offense, more strategy on defense, better communication. I think we had players all on the same page, and I brought in data analytics or sports analytics and film analysis, so we were really prepared, and that was our advantage.
And I think Liz Mills is probably seeking more advantages during the Basketball Africa League tournament, which is being held at the Kigali Arena. That same arena will stage AfroBasket 2021, the African Men's Continental Championship, at the end of August. And I'm sure Coach Mills is scouting players who are currently competing in Kigali. I'm VOA Sonny Young, sending it back to Prince Nesta and VOA Africa's special coverage of the Basketball Africa League.
Thanks, Sonny. And Prince Nesta, and you're listening to special VOA Africa coverage of the Basketball African League in Rwanda. VOA is a radio broadcast partner of the new 12-team league, a partnership of the U.S. National Basketball Association, NBA, and the Geneva-based International Basketball Federation, FIBA. Don't forget you can also track the BAL tournament in Bambara, French, Kenya, Rwanda, Portuguese, and Wolof on VOA Africa, voanews.com, VOA Twitter and Facebook accounts. I earlier spoke with the first ever FIBA commissioner from South Sudan, Aru Ramadan Chan, about his career, his role as a FIBA representative, and his take on the Basketball African League tournament in Rwanda. Here's more.
I am currently the FIBA commissioner for South Sudan Basketball Federation. First one ever for our country, our young country. Aru Ramadan is a former basketball player. I played basketball at different levels. So I played basketball in college. I played in USIU for 6 years. That was in the Premier League, in Kenyan Premier League. And then after I finished USIU, I moved to Uganda, where I joined City Oil, City Oilers. I played with them 2 seasons in Uganda, and we won 2 championships. Those 2 seasons in Uganda, top flight, Ugandan Premier League. And then I went back to Kenya, where I joined the Kenya Port Authority. And I played with them 4 seasons, where I won with them 3 championships in Kenya. And then I thought high time now to go back home. And that's when I decided now to come back to South Sudan to help build the basketball culture in South Sudan. And that's where I am right now. And we are doing our level best to bring basketball up to speed in Africa.
Fantastic achievement. You've come from far, and definitely, you know, you're going to be going far. Exactly. Tell me a little bit about your FIBA basketball gig. What does it entail?
In a nutshell, the work of a basketball commissioner is in charge of officiating the game from outside. You know, I oversee the game from the time before it starts to the actual 40 minutes stopping plus 30 minutes after the game. So I am an overseer of the game. That is on court. Now off court, here back at home, I'll be running clinics to bring our referees up to speed, you know, because once the referees are up to speed, the game will develop. So that is my mandate right now. That is what I'll be doing.
Oh, fantastic stuff. And how long have you been on the job, Paul?
I have been on the job now for less than 2 months since I passed my FIBA examinations. It's been 2 months now.
Nice. And how has it been so far, considering South Sudan is a young country and there's a lot that still needs to be done?
There's a lot of work needs to be done. There's a lot of challenges in South Sudan, you know, from all aspects. But I'm up for the challenge because it's my passion. I want to see the game grow. And our chairman is doing a wonderful job so far with the national team. So now we need to bring whatever that is happening at the African level, we have to bring it back home, you know, to the grassroots. You know, it's not easy, but as a team. I have a good team working with me, the Secretary General. We're all working together, and I am more than positive that we are going to get good results within a short time.
Great stuff. Now, as we all know, FIBA and NBA Africa have actually come together to, you know, develop the Basketball African League tournament that is taking place in Kigali, Rwanda. Tell me a little bit about the tournament. Are you contented with what you're seeing so far?
The tournament is amazing. It is a good initiative. It is exposing our African talents to the world. You know, our boys now have the confidence and have the morale that most of them did not have before. Whatever Ball is doing in Africa is amazing, and we really appreciate, and it's just the beginning. My wish was if the Corona was not there, I know how Kigali Arena, 20,000+ people would be filled up with all fans from all around Africa. That was that's something that was going to happen. But unfortunately, we're going to work with what we have so far. And so far, so good. It's positive. It's been received worldwide positively.
Absolutely. And I totally agree. Exactly what do you think this means for the African continent? The tournament being held in Africa, and of course, as far as exposing African players is concerned, what does the tournament mean for the African continent?
The tournament means a lot to Africa, you know. And in a nutshell, for African players, they now have a platform where they can showcase their talents, and I am very sure within a very short time you're going to see a lot of African players playing in the NBA very soon, because they are now being exposed and they are being seen, you know, by scouts all over the world, and it's a positive thing for Africa as a continent.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've talked about players who, you know, have the potential to play in the NBA. So far, what are the standout performances in the tournament so far for you? Being an experienced basketballer yourself, which are some of the names that you think maybe could actually get to the NBA since they have really performed well in the tournament?
So far, they are very good players. But, you know, the tournament is just beginning. We'll get to know now the cream de la cream when we approach the semifinals and the finals, where now everybody has settled in and so everybody's confident. The butterflies are all out, you know. So we are keeping a closer look at them. So as team now meet each other, and they get to punch each other left, right, as they do, as they spar, we'll get to know who is who as the group stages clear, and then we go to the knockout stages.
You went to school in Kenya, grew up in Kenya, you know, you're from South Sudan. What's happening to South Sudanese teams and Kenyan teams? How come they're not taking part in these competitions?
Yeah, you know, as you know that there are fewer slots, you know, and the competition is very stiff. The competition is very stiff, deservedly so. So I want to believe that next time or next year, the East African teams are going to step up. The East African clubs, you know, this time around, people are concentrating more on the national team. But from what I see now, everybody's hungry, especially those guys that didn't make it. And they know that if they would have worked a little bit harder, they would have made it. They are hungry than before. They are hungrier. And I know that comes next season, we are going to see a lot of East African teams representing Kenya, Uganda, Burundi, perhaps, because we see Rwanda, the Patriots are representing as well. So it was just a lack of adequate preparation in advance, but I'm very sure they're going to catch up.
Absolutely. And there has also been the NBA. Some of the NBA players, you know, were taking part in this tournament, American players, foreign-based players. Do you think so far that blend is working out between, you know, these foreign-based players and African players?
Oh, yes. It is working out. And we encourage it, you know, because when the foreign-based players come and they play alongside the local players in the region, the local players get to learn a lot of things from them, you know, be it on court or off court, both they get to learn a lot. And when they go, the players that are left behind here will have stepped up to what they have seen. So, you know, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. We have no problem with it, and we'll really encourage it.
Absolutely. And, you know, J. Cole has been, you know, playing for the Patriots of Rwanda. Do you think his performance so far has been something worth mentioning?
J. Cole is doing his thing. He's doing his thing. He's doing what he can do for his team, Patriots, and he's representing well. And I know he has not stepped up to his full potential, perhaps because of the butterflies that I talked about. But I am very sure as the tournament progresses, as Patriots go further, he's going to come out of his shell, and he's going to play better than he is. He's playing good, but I know he can do better.
What next for South Sudan basketball, and what next for African basketball after this tournament, especially?
What next for basketball in South Sudan is that now we have to go now all the way to the grassroots and tap the untapped talent, because South Sudan has a lot of talent that is very untapped, you know, and we build academies and we step up our game, you know, so that we can have continuity when these old bananas go away. Okay, so same for Africa generally, you know. Now, given that now everybody is watching their cousins, their countrymen participating in this ball, the young ones are going to be motivated. You know, they want to play alongside the likes of J. Cole. They want to play the biggest stage in Africa could ever present to them, and they're going to be motivated, and they're going to step up, you know. Likewise, every country should go to the grassroots and look for their young talents and tap them. For the next 10 years, we are going to have great competition in this tournament, and a lot of African players are going to be exported outside.
That was Aru Ramadan Chan, the first ever FIBA commissioner for South Sudan, chatting with me about his illustrious basketball career in East Africa, his role as a FIBA representative in the ongoing Basketball African League tournament in Rwanda. And that wraps up our May 22nd pregame show. Thanks to the National Basketball Association, NBA, the International Basketball Federation, FIBA, and the Voice of America for making this broadcast possible. And special thanks to my halftime and postgame co-host, super producer Mukbili Abaru. And thank you for tuning in. That was VOA Africa's special coverage of the historical NBA Basketball African League Championship Games in Rwanda.
Le monde au féminin. Le monde au féminin.